Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, Gladys and Potties. Take pity on, indeed, pray for your dilapidated old presenter who in 5 hours' time will complete a 22-23-hour day. Mind you, some of it was well invested. I went down to Melbourne, out to La Trobe University, where I chaired a discussion on Australian nationalism with a plethora of professors. Bloody interesting. So with a bit of luck, we'll be able to turn it into a programme and play it to you next week. I've got a theory about the Icelandic volcano. I don't think it's a genuine natural volcano at all. I think it was built by brilliant Icelandic engineers as a WMD, a weapon of mass distraction, to take attention away from their tragic economy and also to punish the wider world for being so unsympathetic. I'll be talking to Bjorn Mumquist from the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service shortly, who may not agree with that thesis. Then it's a Harvard bloke, Dr. Aaron Bernstein, who's going to talk to us about the relationship of healthy biodiversity with healthy humans. And last on the program, well, see this book here? I was sent this months and months and months ago from the author. It's a book about his dad. It's called The Duke. And riffling through it, we suddenly realised that it was very interesting indeed. One of the producers was reduced to tears by the end of the book. It's about his dad, who was an absolute 24-carat gold hero. In fact, the book was subtitled A Hero's Hero at Sandakan. The only Second World War soldier to win both the George Cross and the Military Cross, and to die a terrible death, but by any measure, a rather noble one. So that's how we round the program off. Now, let's look at Iceland. Huge clouds of ash and smoke billowing out of that specially created volcano has had some interesting consequences. It's left an estimated 7 million travellers stranded, including Bruce Shapiro. It's got some Mueller's warning that the explosion is because of women behaving shamefully, and it's wiped news of a 2,900-page investigation into the economic crisis off the front page. There's been a lot of emphasis on everyone else being inconvenienced and the sufferings that they've faced at airports, but there hasn't been much attention on the Icelanders themselves. So we thought we'd find out what it's like to be where all this action is happening and what effect these events are having on Icelanders psychologically. Bjorn Mumquist is a journalist with a fraternal organisation, Icelandic National Broadcasting, based in the capital city, and we got him on the blower to tell us about life under the volcano. Bjorn, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello there.
When you look at maps of the countries of Europe affected by the amazing force of nature, the one place where everything looks clear is where you are right now in Reykjavik. Are there any signs of the volcano when you stick your head out the window?
Well, I'm looking out my window right now. It's a bright and sunny day in Iceland. Actually, it's the first day of summer, which is the national holiday. The eruption is taking place about 100 miles east of Reykjavik, and it hasn't had any effect on the capital yet. We are expecting maybe some minor ash fall over the weekend, but that's not even likely. The effects on the local population has been limited to the immediate area around the glacier.
Now, Bjorn, you've personally lived through quite a few volcanic eruptions, haven't you? And so your fellow country people take them, they're a little bit blasé about them.
I wouldn't maybe use the word blasé, but we're used to eruptions. I mean, there have been numerous in recent decades. I mean, I'm 46 years old. There have been probably something like 26, 27 eruptions since I was born. Some of them actually more serious than this one. There was one in 1973 in the Westman Islands, which is a cluster of islands just south of the glacier, which is now erupting. And there, a whole village had to be abandoned in the middle of the night. You know, people transported to, up to the mainland by boats because the lava was just basically coming towards the village and, you know, ended up burying some hundreds of houses there. So so there have been more serious eruptions in recent history in Iceland, but this one, it's been quite some time since we had the last one with the ensuing ash fall that we have been seeing in recent days.
But I understand that it's a part of your culture to take kids out to look at them, that you yourself mm-hmm. have seen, what, 20 or 30?
Yeah, well, it's pretty strange. I remember in 2000 when Hekla erupted, which is probably the most famous volcano in Iceland. It used to be called the Gates to Hell in the Middle Ages. That erupted the last time in 2000, and we had hundreds, probably thousands of people from Reykjavik driving over a mountain pass to take a look. And on the way back, a snowstorm broke, and they were all stuck in the mountains, trying to get back home.
Bjorn, farmers around the world tend to be fairly stoic. In Australia, we deal with floods, bushfires. Currently, and droughts. And currently, a lot of the farms in New South Wales are dreading a biblical plague of locusts. But we cannot imagine what it must be like to see your pastures disappear under this muck. What are farmers doing to keep their animals alive?
Yeah, it's true. That's the sad part of all of this. I mean, there are about probably 50, 60 farms in the region who have been affected by the ashfall. They're all south of the glacier. I mean, the eruption started Wednesday. Ash started falling the day after. The farmers to the immediate south of the glacier bore the full brunt of the ashfall. It was on Saturday that it started falling. They did their best to get their livestock into houses or move them away, but some of them had to be left out on the fields during that day. I think it was about 250 horses that had to stand outside and sort of, you know, wait for it to be over. The farmers now are, I mean, some of them are moving their livestock away. Some of them have been taking animals to the slaughterhouse because there's no place for them in the houses. Mm. Some of the farmers are saying that they are going to abandon their farms, at least temporarily, because there are examples of farmers there who had something like 2 to 3 inches of ash fall on their pastures, and they don't see how, you know, the grass is going to grow this summer.
Well, it takes many years for paddocks in Australia to recover from a grass fire. God knows what the long-term effect of ash is going to be. Now, there were reports of a second eruption during the week, but you say this has been a misunderstanding, that it was actually the wind lifting up already fallen ash.
That's true. The activity in the volcano there up in the glacier has actually been decreasing in recent days, but there's a lot of ash that's falling on the ground and has been falling on the ground in recent days. And there was a time the day before yesterday was a strong northerly wind blowing over there and just kicking up huge amounts of ash and carrying it up into the sky and southwards. So that's why you had reports of a second ash plume coming pummeling towards Europe with the ensuing trepidation by everybody who was stranded somewhere in an airport in Europe. I mean, we have sympathies with the people who are stranded in airports around the world, but these problems are, you know, temporary and nothing compared to the fact that, the people here are dealing with the consequences.
Well, one of the consequences is that your quite significant tourist industry, 500,000 a year, has collapsed because your president has been telling people, don't come to Iceland.
Yeah, there was a controversial comment he made on the BBC the other day. He was basically saying that this present eruption was almost like a rehearsal for another one. There's another volcano quite close to the one that's erupting now. That volcano's name is Katla, and that's bigger by orders of tens of magnitudes. It's vastly bigger. It last erupted in 1918 with a huge flood coming down the mountainside and streaming into the ocean. A lot of ash was blown into the air. The Katla has been blowing once every 100 years or so, and for the last three times, the present glacier, the Eyjafjalla glacier, has been blowing. Katla has been showing some signs of life at around the same time. So we're all sort of on our toes and watching Katla, but it's not showing any signs of life as of yet. And nobody really knows the connection between the two, except for the fact that they have been showing signs of life around the same time.
Bjorn, next week, an old friend of this program, Simon Winchester, will be joining us. He wrote a very fine book on Krakatoa, and
yes,
he's written in The Guardian that volcanoes often change the world in profound ways, ways that no other natural disaster can match. He cites Krakatoa, or he cites Santorini, and he makes the link between the explosion of a volcano called Laki in 1783, which erupted for 8 months.
Exactly.
And ruined crops, and played a role in the French Revolution.
Yeah, that eruption has a very significant place in Icelandic history. This was in June 1783. It was a massive basaltic eruption in the southeast of Iceland. I seem to remember it was something like 25 craters that erupted on a fissure, on a long fissure there, and it was so big that the consequences in Iceland, they have a special name. They're called the hardships. When you talk about the hardships in Icelandic history, everybody knows what they're what you're talking about. We had thousands of people die in Iceland. There was even talk that the Danish government, which ruled Iceland around that time, there was talk of just moving the population of Iceland to Denmark because you couldn't live here. The country was becoming inhabitable, and the consequences in Europe were massive. I mean, there were talks of the summer that never came in 1784. There was a really cold winter on the east coast of the United States, and like you said, the crops failed in Europe, and there are people who say that this led directly to the French Revolution in 1789. So we had these eruptions over time, with massive consequences.
And, of course, you had prepared a story on the 2,900-page report into the country's economic crisis, and it's had to be held in abeyance.
Well, it wasn't really held in abeyance, but it was, the focus shifted suddenly. The report came out Monday last week, and like you said, it was a massive report on the economic collapse of the country, sort of tracking who did what and who was to blame. And we prepared a very good a television program on Monday night, and then we had the stories, the follow-up stories on Tuesday, and then we were sort of, drawing up plans for our coverage on Wednesday, when I got a call at 1:30 in the morning saying, Bjorn, you have to come to work. The evacuations have started east of here because of the eruption is imminent. And then we forgot all about the report for a couple of days.
Bjorn, thanks for giving us some time. Bjorn Malmquist, journalist for Icelandic National Broadcasting Service. This is LNL on ABC Radio National and a multitude of other platforms. And in just a minute, we'll be talking to Dr. Aaron Bernstein.